is the principle of flinching. Flinching says that you should visually react any time a proposal is made to you. Let's say that you're at a resort area and here's one of these charcoal sketch artists doing the sketch. Doesn't have the price posted. And you say to him, how much is the sketch? He says $15. If you don't react, his next words will be, and $5 extra for color. If you still don't react, he'll say, and we have these shipping cartons, you'll need one of those too. As opposed to, with a flinch, how much is the sketch? $15. $15, you say. That's a lot of money. He says, well, look, I'll tell you what I'll do. I normally charge $5 extra for the color, but for you, I'll throw it in at no extra charge. That's still a lot of money, you say. He says, well, come here. I have never, ever done this before, but you're such a nice person. I'll not only throw in the color, but I'll give you one of these shipping cartons. And you see the difference? See, people are watching for your response. Do you have a spouse whose last thing in the world they would ever do is flinch because anything that theatrical is beneath their dignity? My wife is like that. We'll walk into a store and she'll say to the clerk, how much is the coat? $2,000. That's not bad, she says. I'm having a heart attack in the background. The thing is that people are watching for your reaction. Now, you don't have to be as theatrical as I might be, but remember that. Anytime a proposal is made to you, people are watching for your reaction, so don't disappoint them. You'll be amazed at what might happen. Students from all over the country will write me on this one or call me and say, when I first heard that, I thought, how ridiculous. I'm not going to make a fool of myself doing that. But I flinched on this seller. They immediately came down $2,000. And one fellow wrote and said, I was buying a Corvette automobile, and I thought I'd worked out a super deal when I remembered to flinch, and he immediately threw in a whole bunch of extras that I thought I was going to have to pay extra for. So try it and see what happens. A speaker friend of mine who was charging $1,500 for his talks was talking to a company. They had not yet got to the point of price when the training director said, well, we might be interested in having you come in, but we couldn't pay you any more than $1,500. He was about to say, well, that's the price I charge anyway, when he thought, well, let's try flinching. So he said, $1,500? I couldn't do it for that. And right away, the training director came back and said, well, our absolute maximum would be $2,500. $1,000 in 15 seconds for this, I'm prepared to look a little bit stupid. So get in the practice of visually reacting anytime you hear the price of something. Here's the trade-off principle. The trade-off principle says that anytime you're asked for a concession in the negotiations, automatically ask for something in return. Now, we told you earlier, always be sure that you ask for the concession right away because of the cargo principle, the value of service is diminishing rapidly. But the thing is here, ask for something in return right away. Let's say that you are a manufacturer and you're acquiring a product from a sub-manufacturer. And they call you up and say, look, we've got a little bit behind on our schedule here. We had promised you a delivery for October the 1st, but it's going to be 2 weeks late. We won't be able to get it to you until October the 15th. Now, it may be that in this particular situation, you know that you're not going to need that until November the 1st. In actual fact, it's to your advantage not to get it until the 15th of the month because that's 2 weeks of warehouse space, 2 weeks of carrying costs that you can avoid. But even though your initial inclination is to say, sure, that's fine, I still want you to use the trade-off. I want you to say, well, quite frankly, I don't know whether we can go along with October the 15th or not. I'll have to check with the committee and see what they say about it. But let me ask you this. If we can do that for you, what can you do for us? Now, one of three things is going to happen here. Number one, you may just get something. They may just have been thinking, boy, have we got a problem here, and what can we give them as an incentive to get them to go along with this extension? So they may just concede something to you. Secondly, you've elevated the value of the concession. When you're negotiating, never ever give anything away. Always make a big deal out of it. You may need that later on. Later on, you may need to be able to go to them and say, look, you remember last October when you couldn't deliver on time? You know how hard I had to talk to the committee to get them to go along with that extension? Now, look, we did that for you. I want you to do this for us. And the third thing that happens is it stops the grinding away process. If they know that every time they ask you for something, you're going to ask for something in return, then it stops them constantly coming back for more. This is the vice technique. This is the way of squeezing people with a very simple little expression. You'll be amazed at what the vice will get you. Here's the way it works. A proposal is made to you. You smile sweetly. You say, "I'm sorry. You'll have to do better than that." Now, a good negotiator will automatically respond with the counter tactic, which is, "Exactly how much better than that do I have to do?" Trying to pin you down to a specific. But you'll be amazed how often inexperienced negotiators will concede a big chunk of their negotiating range simply because you said that. There's a story about Henry Kissinger when he was Secretary of State during the Nixon years. He had an Undersecretary of State prepare a very extensive paper on Vietnam. It was a very professional affair, leather-bound, gold-engraved, and he sent it in to Kissinger. It came back a couple of days later with a note attached that said, "You'll have to do better than this, HK. Well, he worked on it, and he worked on it. He added more charts and graphs. He sent it back in again, and it came back again with another note on it. "I'm sorry, you'll have to do better than this, HK. So he really poured the midnight oil on this thing. The report got thicker and thicker and more comprehensive. He got it to where he felt that he couldn't do anything more. He didn't want to take a chance on just sending it into Kissinger this time, so he made an appointment through Kissinger's appointment secretary to meet with the great man. He took it in, and he said, "Mr. Kissinger, you've sent this back to me twice already. Please don't send it back again. It's not going to get any better than this. This is the very best that I can do." Kissinger reached across the desk and took it from him, and he said, "Well, in that case, then, I'll read it." It's the same technique that school teachers will use when they don't have time to grade papers. They'll send them back to the kids with a note attached that says, "You'll have to do better than that." The interesting thing is they always come back better. There's always room for improvement from the other side. So try that simple expression, "You'll have to do better than that." Don't forget the counter to it. "Exactly how much better than that do I have to do?" The power of the printed word. Remember when I told you that my daughter came to me for the $1,200 recommended spending money for Europe? She showed me in writing that that was the amount that they were recommending. What chance would she have had of getting the full $1,200 if she'd have just told me about it? See, people believe what they see in writing that they won't believe when they just hear about it. The Candid Camera people did a stunt to prove that a number of years back. You may remember seeing it on television. They posted a sign on a freeway back east that said, "Delaware closed." Alan Funt stood by the sign in a rented trooper's uniform. He wasn't allowed to speak to the people as they came up, only point up at the sign. And it was amazing what was happening. People were coming to a screeching halt and saying things like, "How long is it going to be closed for? My wife and kids are inside." People believe what they see in writing. This is how hotels are able to get people to check out of their rooms on time. Holiday Inns used to have a terrible time getting people to check out of their room at 12 o'clock until they learned the art of the printed word and posted those little signs on the back of the door. Now, 97% of the people check out of their rooms on time without any question at all because the written word is believable. I remember doing a seminar over in Palm Springs one time, and I went there early to play golf on one of those great golf courses. And I was standing on one of the tees about ready to tee off when I saw a little boy standing there, couldn't have been more than 5 or 6 years old, with an egg carton in his hands. Now, those of you who play golf know what that means. He's collected lost balls around the golf course, and now he's going to resell them to the golfers. Well, I thought to myself, and Lord, please forgive me for this awful thought, but I thought, well, I'm going to negotiate the living devil out of this kid on the price of his golf balls, and it'll make a good story to tell at my seminar tomorrow. So I beckoned him over, and without a word, he stood there, and he silently opened the lid of the golf carton. And neatly penciled inside, it must have taken him hours to do it, he'd done it so well, were his prices. Golf balls, $1 each, $4 for $3, $6 for $5, and so on. It devastated me. I bought $5 worth of golf balls, which I need like a hole in the head because we live next to a golf course and our orchard fills up with golf balls all the time. There's an interesting postscript to that story. He was a very sedate young businessman. I felt sure that he'd be just thrilled to death to make a $5 sale, which of course would be $5 profit for him too, since he had no cost in the balls. But he didn't appear to show any emotion at all. He thanked me, walked slowly off to the corner walkway where he would turn to go back to his home, and let out a big yippee and went racing off to tell his parents what he'd done. Not often you get a chance to make anybody happy for $5 anymore. So every chance you get, put things in writing. If you supervise salespeople, for example, and you have to put a price change into effect, be sure that they have it in writing, because there's a world of difference between them sitting with a potential client and saying, look, we're having a price increase at the start of next month, you should order now, and then saying, look at this letter I just got from my boss. It indicates that, look, we're having a price increase on July the 1st. Always show it to people in writing every chance you get. This is the principle of the withdrawn offer. It's very, very effective for drawing the negotiations to a conclusion. And you use it when you get in that situation where you just feel that the people are arm wrestling with you. You know that they want to do business with you, but you just know that at this point in time, they're negotiating for better price and terms. First of all, you have to understand that you may have made the mistake of setting up a pattern in the way that you have negotiated. If, for example, you had $1,000 in your proposal price as flexibility, your negotiating range was that you could give away up to $1,000. The way in which you gave that away is very, very critical. Now, we all have a tendency to want to give the smallest concession we possibly can first and see what happens. So you might initially say, well, I might be able to squeeze another $100 out of the proposal, but that's about our limit. If they turn that back, you might go away and you come back a bit later and you've taken another $200. You've still got $700 left in your negotiating range. Then you go to $300, and then gradually you've got $400 left now, and you get in the whole thing. You see what you've done there? You started with a small concession, and you built up to a larger concession. You'll never bring the negotiations to a conclusion doing that, because every time they ask you for a concession, it just gets better and better. The best way to do it is offer a reasonable concession up front that might just cinch the deal. Maybe a $500 concession wouldn't be out of line, half your negotiating range. And be sure that if you have to make any future concessions, they're smaller and smaller. Your next concession might be $200, and then $100, and then $50. So you convince them by the way that you lower your negotiating range and the size of the concessions that you're making that they have pushed you about as far as they possibly can. But good negotiators know how to do even better than that. Good negotiators know how to take away a concession that has already been granted. Let's say, for example, that the widget salesman comes in to see the widget buyer at a factory, and the salesperson wants a dollar for his widgets. The buyer offers 90 cents. They negotiate back and forth, and finally they arrive at 95 cents. And what's going through the buyer's mind is, boy, I got him down from a dollar to 95 cents. I bet I can squeeze another penny out of him. I bet I can get him to go at 94 cents. So he says, look, you know, business is really tough right now. I just can't do business with you on widgets unless you can bring it in at 94 cents. Now, that may be within the salesperson's range, but here's the effective thing to do to stop this grinding away process. He says, well, I'm not sure if we can do that or not. Tell you what, if I can possibly get it for you, I will. That's good guy, bad guy. Let me go back. We'll refigure it. If I can possibly do it for you, we will. I'll get back to you tomorrow. The next day, he comes back, and he's going to withdraw a concession. He says, look, you know, I'm really embarrassed about this. We've been up all night refiguring the price of widgets. Somebody somewhere down the line has made a mistake. You know, we were talking 95 cents yesterday. I know we were, but we can't even sell it to you for that. 96 cents would be the lowest price that we could possibly offer you on widgets. Now, what's the buyer's reaction? He's going to say, hey, wait a minute, buddy. We were talking 95 cents yesterday, and 95 cents is what I want. And immediately, 94 cents is forgotten. It's called withdrawing an offer to bring the negotiations to a conclusion. Let me give you another example on this, because it's very illustrative of the pattern of negotiations. Let's say that a group of friends have gone together, and they have bought a home up in the mountains to use for a vacation home. There's a whole group of them. They've all gone in together on the cost of it and the expenses, and they're sharing the use of it. Now, one of the partners drops out of the syndication, and your neighbor comes to you and tells you about the cabin in the mountains. Now, your initial reaction to this is, boy, is that fantastic. Would I love to do something like that? However, you're smart enough to play the reluctant buyer role, which we'll cover in detail in our next session together. You say, gee, I appreciate you telling me about that, but I just don't think I'd be in a position to be interested in that right now. I'm so busy, I don't think we'd ever have time to get up there anymore. But look, just to be fair to you, what is the very lowest price that you would sell a share in the home for? Well, he's been studying negotiating too, and he's learned that you never want to be the first one to name a price. So he says, well, quite frankly, we have a committee that decides that, higher authority, and I don't know what that price might be. I can take him a proposal, but I don't know what the suggestion would be. Well, you press him a little bit more for a price, and finally he says, well, I'm pretty sure that they're going to be asking $10,000. This is a lot less than you expected. You were willing to go to 15. And your initial reaction is to jump for it right away, but you're smart enough to remember to flinch. $10,000, you say? Oh, no, I could never go along with anything like that. That's way too much. Tell you what, I might be interested at $8,000. If they're interested at $8,000, let me know and we'll talk about it. Well, the next day he comes back and he's decided to draw you into line by withdrawing the offer. He says, am I embarrassed about this? I know that we were talking $10,000 yesterday, but the committee last night decided that they wouldn't sell a share for less than $12,000. This is psychologically devastating to you. Number one, because you feel you created the problem. You say, boy, I wish I had never studied that negotiating course, because if I hadn't, I would have nailed him down at $10,000 yesterday. And secondly, you've made the mistake of passing the point where you're prepared to walk away. You've probably told your family all about it. They're all excited about the cabin up in the mountains because they know that $10,000 is within your negotiating range. So you've made the fatal mistake. You're not prepared to walk away. You say, Joe, what are you talking about? You said $10,000 yesterday, $12,000 a day is going to be $14,000 tomorrow. What's going on here? He says, well, I do feel badly, but that's what they, higher authority, decided. You say, Joe, come on. He says, well, I do feel badly about this. Tell you what. Let me go back to them one more time. Let me see what I can do for you with them. That's good guy, bad guy, isn't it? If I can get it for you for the $10,000, are you interested? You say, of course I'm interested. I want it. And he's got you at full price, and you may not have realized what he's done to you until it's too late. Haven't we all at one time or another had an appliance salesperson or an automobile salesperson when we were trying to get a little extra concession from them say, well, let me go to my sales manager and I'll see what I can do for you with him. And he comes back and he says, am I embarrassed about this? You know that advertised special we were talking about? I thought that ad was still in effect, but it went off last Saturday. I can't even sell it to you at the price we were talking about. And immediately you forget about future concessions and want to jump on the bandwagon at the price you'd been talking about. Very effective. Here's the art of positioning people for easy acceptance. Very, very important, particularly if you're dealing with someone who's done some studying of negotiating. Very important that you set them up to make them feel good about giving in to you. Because sometimes someone who's done some study of negotiating doesn't want to concede to you, even when it's a win-win solution, because they don't want to feel they lost. So you set them up to make them feel good about giving in to you. You say, Harry, look, I realize you're not getting the best deal in the world here, but look, Harry, I'm backed into a corner on this one. With my partners, I can't move. Do me a favor, Harry, give in to me on this one. I'll make it up to you down life's road. Now, Harry knows that you don't owe him anything. It's just that you've been courteous enough to position him so that he doesn't feel badly about giving in to you. This can also be done with nominal concessions. You say, Harry, look, we're $2,000 a pawn on this thing. I can't budge an inch with my partners. Look, Harry, here's what I'm prepared to do for you. If you'll come down the $2,000, I'm prepared to guarantee you that the payments are always going to be in 5 days ahead of the due date. Now, that's a nonsense concession. Harry knows those payments are not always going to be in on time. But you've just set it up so that he can feel good about giving in to you. Now, never ever gloat. Never ever when you get through negotiating, say, Harry, you know, if you'd have hung in there a little bit longer, I was prepared to do this and this and this for you. Because Harry's going to say unkind things about your mommy when you do that. Always when you get through negotiating, congratulate. However poorly you think the other person may have done in the negotiations, congratulate. You say, boy, did you do a fantastic job negotiating that. I realize that I didn't get as good a deal as I could have done, but quite frankly, it was worth it because I learned so much. You were brilliant. You want the other person to feel that they won in the negotiations. Have you ever watched attorneys down at the courthouse? They'll cut each other to ribbons inside the courtroom, but outside you'll see the district attorney go up to the defense attorney and say, "Boy, were you brilliant in there. You really were. True, your guy got 30 years, but I don't think anybody could have done a better job than you did." Because attorneys don't need any more trouble than they've already got, do they? There's a basic principle in negotiating that you should always try to be the one that writes the contract. When the verbal negotiations are over, it's time for someone to put this in writing. And the person who gets to put it in writing has definite power in the negotiations, because there's bound to be half a dozen little details that you didn't think of when you were verbally negotiating that need to be specified in the written contract. If you're the one that gets to write the contract, you can write those to your favor, and then it's up to the other person to negotiate them out, to do the work of changing it if necessary. So try to be the one that writes the contract. I'll say to the other people, look, we need to put this down in writing, but let's not go to a lot of expense on this. I have an attorney on retainer. It won't cost either one of us anything for me to have my attorney do it. Even if I had to pay the attorney to do it, I still think I'd be better off to be the one that is writing the contract. A fait accompli, which is a French expression which basically means it is done, works like this. You've been negotiating a proposal by mail, possibly. A fait accompli is to send the person a completed proposal with the assumption that they're going to accept it exactly the way it's written. So you mail them the signed contract with the changes made that you want to your benefit. You include the deposit check, and they receive it, and now they've got a decision to make. They can either take the easy route and just accept it exactly the way it's written, although it may be a little less than they wanted to get, or they can now come back, open up the negotiations again, stand a chance of the whole thing breaking down, and go through the time and effort of renegotiating with you. So sometimes a fait accompli, particularly if you're dealing with a relatively small issue, a concession of, say, 5% or less, fait accompli is very effective. Send in the contract, deposit check enclosed with the changes, then they have to make that decision. Funny money. Very critical to good negotiating. Good negotiators learn to understand funny money. There are all kinds of ways of describing the price of something. If you went to the Boeing Aircraft Company and said, "What does it cost to fly a 747 coast to coast?" they would not tell you $52,000. They would tell you 11 cents per passenger mile. Salespeople call that breaking it down to the ridiculous. Haven't we all had a salesperson say to us at one time or another, "Look, do you realize you're talking 35 cents a day here? You're not going to let 35 cents a day stand between you and your dream home, are you?" Well, good negotiators think in real money terms. We're talking about a real estate acquisition here, and 35 cents a day on a 30-year contract is over $7,000. So when you're negotiating, learn to think in real money terms. Don't let people use funny money on you. In our next session together, we'll talk about the decoy and the red herring and the reluctant buyer technique.
This is the end of Side 5. Side 6 is already queued up for your listening.